murder, corruption, greed, betrayal, sex. The new fictional crime novel entitled Network of Killers by author D.B. Reynolds explodes with elements of excitement. To find out more about this explosive book, please visit the author's website at www.d-b-reynolds.com. Available in print edition and Amazon Kindle and Barnes & Noble Nook.
Across every time zone, covering both hemispheres, it's time for another broadcast of Authors First on the Artists First Radio Network. Scott Z sitting in for Tony K tonight. Glad to be here. Tony got called away on personal business, but I taught Tony his job. Am I allowed to say that? Don't tell anybody. So I think I'm qualified to do this. Been here for about 15 years, done about 10,000 interviews. We'll see how I do. Joining us tonight, let me tell you a little bit about our guest tonight. She is and has been writing for over 36 years. She has written works that have appeared in such publications as Essence, Ebony, the Network Journal, Madame Noir, Today's Black Woman, Parade, Sisters in Style, Your Church Magazine, Modern Dad Magazine, The Trenton Times, Family Times, The Preacher's Magazine, Black Living, The New Jersey's Business and Entertainment Weekly, The Pittsburgh Quarterly, The Trenton State College Literary Review, North Carolina University's Literary Journal, Obsidian 2, and several I neglected to mention. She is also the host of her own international radio program called Off the Shelf, which airs on Blog Talk Radio Live, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Saturdays, and that's 24/7 through the rest of the week. She has interviewed the New York Times bestselling author Zane, Francis Ray, Roland Martin, Tyree, and just many, many, many more. She is absolutely qualified to do what she does. Oh, let me just mention as well, she's the co-founder of Bucks County, Pennsylvania's first African-American-owned and operated drug and alcohol intervention program called No Longer Bound. There's a whole bunch more I could tell you about to introduce our guest, but hey, let's just talk about those things with her on the air. Welcome, Denise Turney.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I know you was getting ready to say New York, and I was sitting over here thinking, go ahead. I love the New York Times or the New Yorker. Either one. Pick either one. That's fine with me.
And I'm wearing.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, and you know, I left out a bunch of stuff because we're going to talk about a lot of this, the stuff I left out along the way. I didn't mention that you are the author of several different books, Love Pour Over Me, which we're going to talk about tonight. It looks like Portia and Love Has Many Faces, Spiral and Long Walk Ups. Just to mention a few, but let's back up. Many of our listeners, Denise, are going to be hearing about you for the very first time. So let's talk a little bit about you as a person. I mentioned just a few things. Let's go back. What about your childhood? Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Dayton, Ohio, and I love my hometown, a small town. Of course, when I was a kid, I thought Dayton was just one happening city. I thought it was so big. And now that I'm grown, my sister still lives there, and I have aunts and uncles there. But I go back, and I think, wow, I thought this was a big city. But when you're a kid, so I was born and raised in Dayton, Ohio, and then when I was 10 years old, my dad moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, so I went completely. Like, it's like going to another world from the Midwest of Ohio, which to me was the north, all the way down south, and I'd never been south before, to Knoxville, Tennessee, from 10 to, I think it was 22 when I joined the Navy, and that's how I got here, to the East Coast, and then I just started traveling. After I got out of the Navy, I ended up in Trenton, New Jersey, and then now right outside of Philadelphia. So that's my background, and I've always loved to read since as long as I can remember. I remember one time my grandmother asked me, what did I want for Christmas? And I said, books. And she said, that's not a good Christmas present. Because I was a little kid for it, but that's what I wanted. So my aunt came upstairs and told me, she said, I'll make sure you get some books. And there weren't as many, a variety of children's book back then. So I read a lot of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. For those who grew up in the 1970s, like I did, those stories, those books might be familiar to your listeners. But that's my beginning. My love of books, again, as long as I can remember, it's been something that I have loved to do.
Well, when did you think that reading is one thing, but writing is completely different? At what point in your life, I guess, when did you have your first published piece of work?
I was, oh my goodness, maybe I was about 12. But I knew from just inner wisdom, inner guidance. I was told when I was 10 that I was a writer. So that's how that came to me. I mean, before that, if that hadn't happened, I probably would have just read and devoured a lot of books as an avid book reader. But when I got that inner guidance, that inner wisdom came through when I was 10, that's when I started writing. And I had read a lot of books. But I didn't know the process as a 10-year-old. How do you go about becoming an author? And I the first early pieces I wrote were poems, which a lot of people start out with. And I started out with poems, and I worked actually with a poet. I can't remember his name, and he told me that what I pretty much knew, that really wasn't my forte. He said, but years down the road, you might be able to revisit that and write some great poems. And I tried short stories. And finally, I was 12 years old when I started on my first novel, which I may never publish because it's like my baby. And I finished it when I was 18. It ended up being 400 pages. But,
wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, I was thinking at your description of knowing that you wanted to be a writer. I'm a professional musician, but I can't read music. I've made hundreds of thousands of dollars playing music, and I can't read a note of music because most of contemporary music is played by what we call played by ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can just sit down and play a piano. If I can hear it, I can play it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a natural ability, and I think maybe what you were describing is similar in some authors, that they are just born to do this.
And even under those, in those situations, even if you're born to do something, you still, I think, need some coaching. And as a writer, my coaching comes through, as many authors, from working with a good editor and also working with other professional writers. Even if you're born with a skill, you still need to sharpen it and hone it. And for some reason, Bruce Lee just popped into my mind. Even he, with his awesome, amazing, oh my goodness, that man practiced like insanely. So you still need to really hone your craft, and that's something that I continue to do today.
Well, who was it that told you? Was it a divine revelation to you, or did someone actually encourage you at the age of 10 to write?
No, it was, I call it inner guidance, or your own spirit within. Some people might refer to it as God. But just something deep within, it was something in me, not something I heard audibly or anything, but deep within me, I was reading a book of poetry. My sister had brought it home. She was about 8, and she had run home from school, and I had gone through almost every book in the library. It was Flanagan Elementary. I don't even know if that school's still around when we were in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I thought I had found every book, and particularly every book written by an African-American author, because there weren't that many. And she came home with a book of poetry by Gwendolyn Brooks, and I'm thinking, how did she find that? And I didn't find it. And then she said, I'm going back outside to play, and ran back downstairs. She never read the book. And I laid it up on the pillow because I was in a bad mood, and then eventually I picked it up and I read it. And after all the books I read, and I've heard other people say this about different situations, it's just those characters literally came alive. I can't explain it. Reading that book, after reading so many books that happened at one time, when I sat down from reading that book, that's when that inner guidance told me I was a writer. And I've heard other people say that they'll say, you know, I passed that same sign for 10 years, and then one day it just jumped out at me.
Right, just like a light, it goes off, and I suppose it can go off at any age. Luckily for you, it happened early, and it set you on the right path. But, boy, we've interviewed authors that written their first book in their late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, it's never too late, folks, right?
Exactly, exactly.
And how many people out there, at best count, you have at least 6 books out now, right?
I released Rosetta's Great Hope, which was a children's book, but I don't have I want to get an illustrator for it. But I try to release it. I don't think you should release a children's book without good illustrations. It really doesn't work. But it was going to be a series book. So that would make, first was Portia, which Portia's the story of a successful defense attorney living in Chicago, Illinois. And she has a marvelous family background. Her father was active in the civil rights movement. And they grew up on the south side of Chicago. And her mother is a school teacher, and she's very well respected as a public school teacher. And at the opening of Portia, that is named after the main character of the book, she's coming out of an abusive relationship. And she can't understand why she entered into an abusive relationship, and neither can anybody in her family, because that was not modeled to her. So anyway, she's down on relationships at this point. But she, every year she had gone to a Christmas party that was put on by one of the leading newspapers in the city. So she went, and that's where she met a guy who turned out to be the love of her life. And as soon as she was getting ready to go, before they got their marriage license, she went to the doctor to get an exam, and she discovered a lump in her breast. So it's an inspirational story about dealing with breast cancer, and it's not a down story, but I do touch on the reality of that situation. I have women who went through it actually read it to do it justice for people who actually had gone through that. And I wrote that story when I actually had a breast cancer scare myself.
Wow.
So it was, that added another element of authenticity to it. But readers loved Portia. Oh, my goodness. And I published Portia in 98. So that was my first book. And it's written in a memoir-type format. And then my next one was Love Has Many Faces, which is a murder mystery set in the Chelsea district in New York City. And anybody who loves the arts, and not just writing, but paintings and music and plays and any type of the arts, would love, you know, the Chelsea district back when this Love Has Many Faces is set in. It was just big. That's where a lot of the artists in the city lived. So that one's about 300 pages. Portia's a short novel, about 100 pages. And then Spiral is a murder mystery set in the 1940s. I love Spiral. I love all my books. Spiral is a book that will keep you glued to the pages to find out what is going to happen next, because it's a deep murder mystery that you have to pay attention to find out who's involved, who really did what. Although it's not written like a whodunit, but it's set in the 1940s in Memphis, Tennessee, Shelby County. Anybody familiar with Memphis knows how the government, the politicians, the mayor were entrenched in Shelby County, and things were tough for certain people back in those times. So and there's a family, African American family, that owns a grocery store in Shelby County, and one of their the grandmother, she's very, very, I won't say headstrong, but she's a very dominant personality, absolutely a dominant personality. But one of her oldest son, he falls in love with a girl, and she doesn't feel right about his father. And then that's where the story takes off from. So that Spiral, that was my third. And then my fourth novel, I'm trying to remember, my fourth novel, I'm thinking Long Walk Up. Long Walk Up was my fourth. And that's another inspirational story. And it's also small, like Portia. And it tells the story of a little girl, Mulliken. And she's from East Africa. Now, it's fictional, so the locations are fictional in the story. The end location is really, I wrote it sort of like a depiction of Madagascar, which is an island off the coast of Africa. But she grows up, and her her family, what they called tribe or community. The modern term is, I've heard, is community instead of using the word tribe. Her mother, her father has passed away, and malaria is coming through. She's lost all her siblings, and her mother passes away. And she just, she could stay there with the community, and they would blend her in just like she was one of their own, but she didn't fully feel that that's where she belonged. The people would look out for her, and she knew that. But something kept calling her over this hill. And so she's 6 years old, and she takes off on her own, and she meets some people who help her along the way. And she also, you know, goes through a lot of challenges. Now, it seems almost unbelievable that a six-year-old would be on their own, but this happens. This happens in other countries. I mean, it is not as uncommon as it is here, although there are street children here, but I don't know if they're as young as six. But in other parts of the world, there are that young, 5 and 6 years old. But anyway, she goes on to become Africa's first woman president. And I no sooner had published Long Walk Up than I, either somebody told me or I saw in the newspaper that that actually happened in real life in Africa. And so I was very happy.
I believe it was the Ivory Coast? A woman was just elected president. First,
I remember hearing that on the news.
I think it was. I remember hearing about that. In fact, I heard her speak on a national public radio program. Yeah, you're right. That recently, that happened in 2011, I believe.
Yeah, it might have happened before then. I think it happened before then, unless there was another woman elected. But I think it happened before then. And I know she had a hard journey to get where she was. But it was soon after, or around the time I published Long Walk Up, that actually happened. I was very happy to hear that of the 50-plus countries in, you know, on the continent of Africa, that finally they had a woman president. And then I wrote Rosetta's Great Hope, which, if you know Pippi Longstocking, which was it's my favorite childhood character, is Pippi Longstocking. Rosetta is sort of like Pippi Longstocking. She is just that bold, that brazen. So that was my first children's book, Rosetta's Great Hope. And then I came out with Love Pour Over Me last month. And Love Pour Over Me, oh my goodness, this is the first book I've written like this. And I wouldn't refer to it as a romance novel, although there is definitely a relationship between the main character, Raymond, and a woman by the name of Brenda that Raymond meets when he leaves Ohio. His father is he's an alcoholic who is not receiving treatment. That's the best way to put it. And he raised Raymond on his alone from the time Raymond was two, and he parents with an iron fist. And so Raymond is thinking, I've got to get out of here. He's very bright. He wins academic awards in high school, and he's also an outstanding track and field runner. So he heads for Pennsylvania, and that's as soon as he sees her, he knows she's the one. And I was recently watching, Crazy Something Love, with, and I can't remember the name of the guy who's in it, but he said the same thing in the movie to his wife. When he was 15, he said, as soon as I saw you, I knew. So Raymond knows, but it's hard to untangle yourself from your past. It's hard to untangle yourself from the training that you received as a child, and try as he might, it is really, really hard for Raymond. And so there are scenes in the story and situations that I'm sure readers will wish, oh my gosh, I wish he would just stop, or I wish it would turn out differently. But it, Love Pour Over Me has a wonderful, wonderful ending that readers can truly, truly celebrate. And there's also a murder mystery in the story. Raymond finds himself entangled in an unsolved murder almost as soon as he arrives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Now, you know, I'm in Ohio right now. You know,
oh, you are?
Yeah, we are in an alliance up near Canton.
Oh, okay.
Canton and Akron and Louisville. And,
yes.
We are. So I know from whence the Ohio people come from.
Okay.
And, of course, you're a fellow Buckeye down
yes.
there, being an original. Lots of friends I have actually live in Dayton, as a matter of fact.
Wow. Okay.
So I have to ask the question then. Obviously, nobody grows up in a bubble. you know, a character like Raymond, a character like Brenda, you know, is that somebody in your life? Now, I know you, you may not want to say, yeah, that's my next-door neighbor, Bob, but, you know, obviously you can't go through life and not experience people.
Right.
So, you know, is Raymond a composite? Do you know someone like Raymond, or is this total fiction?
No, Raymond is not someone that I have, the best I can recall, I've never done that. I have created characters and later thought, you know, some parts of the person might remind me of myself, or the grandmother I told you about in Spiral, she reminds me a little bit of my paternal grandmother, but I didn't set out to create the characters and base them off of any one person or a group of people. So no, Raymond just, he came together while I was creating the story, the same as Brenda. There's nobody I can think of that I would say that person reminds me of Raymond or that person reminds me of Brenda. They just came together and fleshed them out as I created the story.
Well, let's talk about your modus operandi. You've already put out 6 books. A 7th one's underway. At the beginning of the program, we mentioned numerous publications that you've written pieces for. How does it work for you? You just get up in the morning, flip a switch, and there you go?
Well, I actually also do nonfiction writing, and that pays a lot of my bills. So I work with a lot of different clients, which is the Madame Noir that you mentioned, and other clients in the education space, whether it's in business, small business predominantly, or insurance. So I do a lot of that, and then I just have to sit down and start writing whatever the client is telling me they want. And then you, I know you already know this, with the Internet, who would have thought? When the Internet first took off, I think for writers, particularly writers who worked for newspapers and magazines and journals, print media, they thought, oh, my gosh, this is not good because we're losing our jobs because people aren't buying newspapers and magazines like they used to. They're not getting their information through print. They're getting it digitally. But I got to tell you, I was telling somebody recently, the Internet has opened up a world of opportunities for writers, and I'm thinking about the writing client work that I do. Oh, my gosh, how many companies are looking for copywriters and medical writers and grant writers and people to write web content and SEO writing? I mean, it's just like endless. So, and then magazines and newspapers who also want reporters and journalists to write for their online, you know, their online websites for their online presence. So that's what I do. I mean, I do that often. And then somehow I managed to write a novel.
Yeah, you think the last thing you'd want to do after you fill a client's request for something you're really not interested in, but you got to do it anyway, and then, hey, I know, let's write some more.
Yes.
So, what, you know, as a musician, often it's a trait, a common stereotype among musicians that's probably true. We burn a lot of late-night oil. It's quiet. There's less interruptions, and a lot of musicians are just night people. How do you fit all of this into your schedule?
For my client work, I do say to myself, okay, I'm going to work on this client's project on, like, let's say Monday from, I don't know, 8 to 2, and then I'm going to do some edits, and I'll do this on Tuesday or whatever. That's how I do my writing client. With my novel writing, I definitely focus on that more on the weekends. And then when I am finished with my writing client work, I'll sit down and work on a novel. But I don't work on, I just released Love for Over Me, so now I'm in the marketing promotion phase of the book. But I have started my next novel. But my top priority right now is getting the word out about Love Pour Over Me. And then, you know, in between that, I also will work on a novel. And I think things that are meant to happen and that you are passionate about and that you want to do, like you were mentioning about music burning the midnight oil, you'll find time to do it. It just happens when you really want to do something, you're committed and you're passionate about it. Your schedule will just open up some mysterious way and you'll find time to sit down and do what it is that you enjoy.
Because think back in 1998 when you opened up a box And there it is. There's Portia. The first book you've written, you've got a copy in your hands. And that's validation, folks. I mean, how many of you folks listening out there have a novel, as they say, in the drawer? What do you mean in the drawer? Well, it's not finished. I never finished it. And then how many of you folks never will finish it? You know, why not? What's the difference? And I'll pose this question to Denise. What's the difference between the great author out there that never finishes the book and the one that does?
Wow. Part of it, I think, and somebody was just saying on Facebook that were dealing with writer's block. Part of it, I've heard writers saying that earlier in my writing career, I dealt with this just a little bit. Writers self-edit, and some writers tell me they never stop doing that. But I would say a lot of writers early in their career, they self-edit. So you go to start writing a sentence, and then you say, no, that's not right. So then you delete it. You ball the paper and throw it in the garbage. And then you start over. And then that keeps happening over and over and over and over. And you could sit there for 10 hours and only have a paragraph because you keep self-editing and telling yourself, no, that's not right. No, that's not right. No, that's not right. So I tell writers, just put the editor to the side. You're going to write a really good book or to put a really good book out, you're probably going to work with a professional editor. I definitely would recommend it anyhow because you can't catch everything yourself. So just get the story down. Just get the story down. That's the first step. Just get the story down. It doesn't have to be just the way it's going, the finished product. It's not the finished product. That's your first step. That's your first draft. Just get the meat and bones, get the story down, and then go back and self-edit. And I think that's one of the key differences between somebody who continues to say they're working on a novel, but they don't publish it. The self-editing, the constantly second-guessing their own talent, themselves, the story, or comparing themselves to another writer, thinking that their story isn't as good. Just get your story down. You have a story in you that only you can tell.
That's true. And I know many brilliant musicians who never play anywhere. They're always trying to, you know, they feel they're just not good enough. And are you kidding me? You know, what good is it if you write a book and no one ever reads it, or if you learn to play an instrument and no one hears you play it? I mentioned, or maybe I didn't actually, during the opening of the show that you are a public speaker and have spoken at major festivals and colleges and universities. However, even though someone may have seen you at Philadelphia Community College give a heck of a speech, that will come and go. It's what you put down in writing that be here for now with the internet forever.
Right.
If this radio program, the shows you do on Blog Talk, unless a massive solar ejection changes the magnetism and erases all the magnetic data in the whole world, your books will outlive you generations from now. People will be able to listen to you talk about your books here.
Wow, you know? Yeah, and that's true. And, you know, before we wrap up today's show, I wanted to read for the Artist First audience an excerpt from Love Pour Over Me. Whenever you let me know that you have time, I wanted to definitely do that.
Oh, absolutely.
So they can get a feel for the story for themselves.
Well, why don't you cue that up, and I'll tell the listeners while you're doing that you are listening to a broadcast of Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network. Folks, do you know that 82,000 people on average listen to these shows? Many shows over 400,000, a couple over a million. We are so grateful to all the listeners that tune in and support the many fine authors that come on our network, like our guest Denise Turney. And by the way, let me tell you that you can surf on over to chistell.com. That's spelled chistell.com. Or you can use the link that's provided next to either the archive or the show tonight. And you can see this lovely woman we're speaking to tonight. And you can also buy a book directly from that website. And you know what? Hey, are there other places we want to mention where the books are available?
It's actually on Amazon.com, and I tell people, any digital retailer, and we'll also be bringing out a print issue here in a couple of weeks, but it's on Amazon.com, and Amazon has it on sale right now. So I tell folks, this is a good time to pick up Love Pour Over Me, because it is actually on sale at 23% off the sticker price at Amazon.com. You can also get it at Barnes & Noble, Google Reader, Ingram Digital, iTunes. You can get it in PDF format. You don't need to have an ebook reader to get Love Pour Over Me. If you have a mobile device, you say, I want to download it, PDF in my mobile device, and I'll just read it off my mobile device. You can do that. Or just off your computer or your laptop, however you want to do it. But again, it's available at Amazon.com on sale right now, Barnes & Noble, Google Reader, Ingram Digital, iTunes. You can also get it at eBookit. If you go to eBookit, you can get it in any format. Any format. You can get it in, I think it's Mobi. You can get it in PDF. You can get it in the, for the Kindle, the Nuke, any way you would like to have it. But when you go to eBookit.com, just type in Love Pour Over Me by Denise Turney, and scroll down through the author list, and then you'll see Love Pour Over Me, and you can order it in whatever format that you want to order Love Pour Over Me in.
Listeners may be interested to know that several years ago, the tipping point happened, and that tipping point is the total number of books sold, all books sold in every format. More books are now sold as digital copies. And the different ways you were talking, then all of the paper copies combined.
Wow.
It will never go back to that. There will always be paper copies of books and magazines. The same thing happened in the radio and record business about 5 years ago. In fact, just as a footnote, all the major record labels have announced that shortly in the future they will be discontinuing production of CDs.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, forget it. And why would you? The MP3 technology of the iPod and MP3 players and your phone, you know, you can store what would be hundreds of CDs on your iPhone now. You know, it's just going away. How things have changed. Well, let's. I hope I've given you enough time to prepare to give us a passage.
I am ready. I'm excited to read an excerpt from Love Pour Over Me. And to the Artist First listeners, first of all, thank you so much for tuning in to today's show and to my followers. I thank all of you for tuning in. And again, you can go get, you can read even more excerpts from Love Pour Over Me for free at www.chisto.com, but I would absolutely love it if you purchase a copy and read it. I heard from a reader who told me they take it to bed with them every night. They've got it on a Kindle, and they are truly enjoying it, and they're halfway through the book already. Love Pour Over Me, just to give you a little background, it's set in the 1970s. So in the 1970s and the 1980s. So anybody who loved that time period, it will ignite some of the sweetest memories for you. That was a time of great change here, and it brought forth a lot of good change, the 1970s and the 1980s. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that time, Love Pour Over Me will introduce you to that wonderful time that I so enjoyed. So I want to begin, and I'm on page 10, and in chapter 1, and the whole excerpt, I'll jump down a little bit, and I'll let you know when I do that, but it's all coming from chapter 1. It was 8 o'clock. Raymond told himself not to, but he turned partway and glanced over his shoulder. It was as if he'd suddenly been plagued with dementia because he forgot the years of abuse heaped upon him with Malcolm's calloused hands. He wanted Malcolm to walk through the convention center doors sober and real proud-like. He wanted Malcolm to be glad to call him his son. And now I'm jumping down. And this actually is Raymond at his high school graduation. Malcolm is his father, and he was waiting, hoping that his father would come to his high school graduation where he won many awards. And so I'm just jumping down about 2 pages. Damn, Paul muttered when he turned around and faced the stage for the 8th time. He bumped shoulders with a guy who stood next to him. That bleep ain't coming. He lowered his head and his voice. Race Pops ain't coming. This young man has earned all city, all county, all state, and top national honors in cross country and track and field. In fact, twice he's been listed as a top high school miler in the country by Sports Illustrated and Track and Field News. He has earned 4 presidential academic citations. He's been on the honor roll since the 7th grade. Principal Jones scanned the auditorium for Malcolm. When he didn't see him, he spoke slower and started to make things up, in the hopes that time will become Raymond's friend. I remember when he first came to Baker, he was a scared young man, but not anymore. He pursed his lips and gave Raymond a nod. He's ready to take advantage of the full scholarship his achievements have gained him. Principal Jones glanced at the doors. A few students and several parents squirmed in their seats. Some people glanced at their watches as if to say, come on. He has maintained a 4.0 grade point average since the ninth grade. He hasn't missed a day of school since the third grade. The doors demanded his attention again, but no one came through them. Ladies and gentlemen, please congratulate Baker High School's class of 1984 valedictorian Raymond Clark. Paul clapped until his hands stung. A few students stood in their seats and hollered, "Go, Ray!" Before long, a chant went up. All the students pumped their fists in the air and shouted, "Raymond! Raymond!" Raymond's heart beat wildly in his chest. He clamped his teeth down against his bottom lip and jailed the rising emotion. He extended his hand when he neared Principal Jones' side. "Well done," Principal Jones told him as he handed him his diploma. He patted Raymond's back. "You did a fine job, son." He shook his head. "A fine job." The chain lock was on the front door when Raymond got home that night. He jiggled the chain and tried to get it to slide open. When that didn't work, he walked to the back of the house and tried to open the rear door. He cursed as he realized the chain lock was on the back door as well. Then he looked for an opening. He was in luck. The kitchen window was ajar just enough to allow him entry. He grunted and pushed up. The screen didn't even bang when it landed in the sink. He crawled through the window like a thief. When he reached the stairs, he saw a flicker of light coming from the second floor. "Dad!" he called out softly, then louder as he made his way up the stairs. "Dad!" A newly pressed blue-striped suit hung across the chair in the corner of his father's bedroom. The television was turned down so low it sounded like it was humming. "Dad!" The bed was empty, covers bunched together near the foot. The shade to the room's one lamp was tilted as if someone had punched it. "Dad!" Raymond walked across the hall. He started to scream, "Dad!" He ran back down the stairs. "Dad!" he screamed as he made his way through the house. He saw the shadow, curled and bent like an old man, at his bed's edge. Silence was his escort into his own room. Malcolm stood slowly. His body leaned right, from his shoulders to his ankles. His hands were clenched. His eyes were slits. "Why didn't you tell me?" he demanded. His hands and his arms and legs quaked. He took heavy Frankenstein-like steps toward Raymond. "Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me?" When no more than a few inches separated them, Raymond saw the red in his father's eyes. Malcolm stepped forward again, and this time Raymond stepped back. He prepared to duck. "Tell you what?" he stammered. Fear had gone into his body. He felt like instead of blood, electricity was coursing through his veins. "Why didn't you tell me?" "What? What, Dad?" Raymond screamed. "Tell you what?" And I'm going to stop right there.
Man, I'm there. Man, I'm there. I'm living every second of that. That is outstanding. Is your book available as an audio book?
No, not right now. It's not.
You do a great job reading your material.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I was right, boy. You just draw the reader right in. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
And that's just like one of the scenes in chapter one, just to set the scene between, so people can see Malcolm and Raymond's relationship. Now, some readers told me they just absolutely hated Malcolm, but if you finish Love Far Over Me, I don't think you'll say that when you get to the end. Because his father doesn't, I'm not going to say whether he changes a lot. I'll tell you this, he doesn't do a lot of changing, but we all have to change some, and I think readers will understand how Malcolm got to be Malcolm. Just like they'll understand what sometimes keeps Raymond from accepting love, and in large part his relationship with Malcolm. But there's a scene with Malcolm near the end of the story. I think it'll make readers actually cry. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I can remember in my high school days, the kid's name Raymond was Paul. He's a kid from the street. Same thing. Alcoholic father, never showed up for anything. I can remember at the football game, senior night, he was the only kid in the whole damn school whose dad wouldn't walk across the field with him because he was a drunk idiot.
Wow.
So you sort of, the coach walked across the field with him. And, you know, what an effect that had on that kid. You know,
yeah.
And I saw that, and you're talking about Raymond, and I'm relating that experience. And, you know, it's lots of people can become, can produce children, but maybe not everybody should be a parent,
right?
Unless you have some skills. But yeah, I got drawn into that right away. The audiobook thing is would be great in your case because you read your material well, and folks like me that drive a lot, it's great to listen to books instead of some crazy shock jock in the morning. Was there a target audience you were writing this book for?
Well, I generally write for it, and most of my books have been for women. If I had to say it, for any reader, but more as a target audience, women between the ages of 25 and about 50. But Love for Over Me is very different. It's like a departure from some of the other stories that I have written with a male character as the main character. And except for Brenda, most of the main characters in the story are men. And because when Raymond goes to Pennsylvania, he meets a motley crew of friends. And they're from, one of his friends is from Italy, and one is from Mexico, and then he has another friend from the U.S. So it's different in that regard. I've never written a story with, I don't think I have, with a man as the main character. I've certainly written novels with men who had a dominant presence in a book, but not where they were the main character. And it's, for me as the author, the relationship between Raymond and Malcolm is very moving for me, particularly as you continue to read the story. And then also the relationship, of course, Raymond and Brenda, but Raymond and his friends, their relationship is something that's very sweet about the book. But they, they're real guys, you know, but it's just their friendship that is enduring. They get caught up in some situations, I'll tell you that. But they have an enduring friendship that, I don't know. You know, I hear men and women say they've been friends with somebody for decades. And this is the type of friendship that Raymond has with his friends.
You know, I wonder, you being the co-founder of the Bucks County, Pennsylvania's first African-American owned and operated drug and alcohol intervention program entitled No Longer Bound, that might give you some serious insight to the mess people can make of their lives when they get involved with drugs and alcohol. And, it probably contributes in some way to why the book is written so well.
It might, you know, difference. I will say this as an author, and I've asked other book authors this, novelists, do you find that you draw upon your own life experiences even when you purposely strive not to do that? And I think every artist does. I remember an interview with, considering you're a musician, that Prince did years ago, and he's very, I don't think, tight-lipped when he does interviews, which is very rare. But he said, why should I do interviews? My whole life story is in my music. Not that he sets out to create a song based on what he's experiencing, but I've heard other artists say the same thing. Maxwell just came to mind, that some recent experience that they have, I forget that hit song Maxwell had out a couple of years ago, but it was based on a real-life breakup that he had, and that song just took off. But I hear a lot of artists say that even if they don't intend to, their own, just ingredients from their own personal experiences find their way into their work.
Well, and even though some novels are obviously written as fiction, sometimes the author is wearing their life on their sleeve. The average person would not walk up to a total stranger and say, listen, here's the most intimate dark secrets about my life. You know, a musician does that. He writes a heartbreaking song because he lost a girl. But, you know, I mean, it's a different venue. You'd think somebody was nuts if they walked up to you on a bus platform and started telling you about how she left me high and dry. But boy, when it comes to art, the artist does it all the time.
Yeah.
And it's sort of expected. And you know what? I think the reader or the listener can tell when it's not genuine. When you're making it up, you know what I mean, in a way, that you're not drawing on some experience or some, you know, tapping into your brain from your past experiences in some real way. You can't write about everything you know because you haven't done everything yet.
Right.
But anyway, I guess what I'm trying to say is in other occupations, most people don't have to, take out their deepest, darkest secrets and expose it to a bunch of strange people.
Yeah, and again, like you said, with artists and then the listener or the reader, they can tell They don't know, and I think, like, again, myself and other authors I've spoken to tell me they purposely try not to do that, and some artists purposely do it, but the reader can tell if the story is authentic. They can tell. They can pick it up and tell if it's something that the author themselves believes in and stands behind and is passionate about, or did the author just write the book because that's what's popular right now, they wanted to sell a lot of copies of the book, or does this really come from deep within the author? Do they really care about this story and these characters themselves? And I think that comes across to readers.
I agree. I think talent is hard to hide. If you're good at something, it's going to rise to the top, period. And if you're a fake and just doing it for the, you know, send me a check because I wrote a book, well, I think, you know, mm-hmm. that becomes evident. Earlier in the broadcast, you mentioned that back when you were growing up that there weren't that many black authors writing children's books. There probably weren't that many black authors being published, period, in any case. However, now look at things.
Yes.
What a dramatic change has happened in one generation.
Yes.
Anybody can publish a book now.
Yes.
Anybody. And, okay, Amazon is going to try to fix the price on your ebook now. Oh, did you hear about that, didn't you?
No.
Oh. Hey, listeners, here's another vote of integrity for the people in the publishing business. Apple is one. Apple is one of them, and several major publishers. You can look this up on Google. They just came to a settlement with the Justice Department because they've been fixing the price of ebooks.
Mm.
Oh, great! More corporate corruption and greed, and who gets the short end of the stick? Everybody, that's right, you do. So they can put a couple hundred more million in their pockets and go buy another island and a few more jets. It's terrible that they're living the publishing industry and they're living down to their reputation because remember they took their cues from the music business, which is basically organized crime. Am I allowed to say that? Well,
no,
I did.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the way it is, folks. So anyway, getting back to the point I was making, anyone now can put out a book. And this is a terrific thing because you don't necessarily have to get in bed with a major publisher. So I guess, you know, here's our guest, Denise Turney, who has written, she's on her seventh book. And, of course, you do go through a publisher. But what advice, you know, you mentioned earlier about the editing. Of course, you need to get an editor. But, you know, what advice would you give someone who can't get a book deal, that someone that's just starting out? You know, don't leave it in the drawer. Get it done.
Yeah, I would. You hit the nail on the head. Now, years ago, and so much has changed in the book publishing industry, and for a client of mine, I actually wrote an article, an international client, on what happened to Napster and how the music industry came after them. Oh, and they said, what would have happened if the music industry had have worked with Napster? We're going back over 10 years because the music industry, trying to fight this digital file sharing, it cost them billions of dollars. So I think the book industry learned from the music industry and didn't go down that same path. But today you can write, you know, years ago you had to wait for a book publisher, whether they were a small independent firm or one of the larger ones like Random House or Penguin, et cetera, to pick up your work. Well, they couldn't publish everybody's book, as we now see with all the many books on the market. And just because your book wasn't published didn't mean it didn't have merit or that it wasn't, you know, any good or of quality. So now authors, and I want to say this started back in the late 90s, and it didn't take off real big, but it started then. They started self-publishing their own work. Now, it was in print, so they would go to a printer and price their work, and then they would just go hit the road and go to a lot of different book events and do book signings and market and promote their work. Bookstores weren't open to that back then, though. If you were a self-published author, they weren't open to giving you book reviews. They weren't open to carrying your book, because I know some authors who really had to beat the door down to get their books in bookstores.
That has
all changed.
Yeah, don't forget that those bookstores were being pressured by the big publishing houses. You will not give shelf space to those undiscovered authors over there, or we're going to do something bad to you. They were threatened by their suppliers.
Right. That's all changed. And that's proof that if you just keep pushing, You can move forward. There's no reason to say I can't. I mean, you might have to join forces with other people, but if you keep moving forward, and what happened in the book industry, and again, I'm thinking back to Napster. Look, they fought Napster, and what Napster was initially trying to do, it's happening anyway. It's happening anyway. And so on large scale, same thing with the book publishing. And so you can write a manuscript,